The town meetings led to a complete overhaul of police priorities to focus on the Blue Ocean strategy of broken windows. Crime went down, and the neighborhood felt safe again. When you want to wake up your organization to the need for a strategic shift and a break from the status quo, do you make your case with numbers? Or do you get your managers, employees, and superiors, and yourself, face-to-face with your worst operational problems? Do you get your managers to meet the market and listen to disenchanted customers holler? Or do you outsource your eyes and send out market research questionnaires? Jump the resource hurdle. After people in an organization accept the need for a strategic shift and more or less agree on the contours of the new strategy, most leaders are faced with the stark reality of limited resources. Do they have the money to spend on the necessary changes? At this point, most reformist CEOs do one of two things. Either they trim their ambitions and demoralize their workforce all over again, or they fight for more resources from their bankers and shareholders, a process that can take time and divert attention from the underlying problems. That's not to say that this approach is not necessary or worthwhile, but acquiring more resources is often a long, politically charged process. How do you get an organization to execute a strategic shift with fewer resources? Instead of focusing on getting more resources, tipping point leaders concentrate on multiplying the value of the resources they have. When it comes to scarce resources, there are three factors of disproportionate influence that executives can leverage to dramatically free resources on the one hand, and multiply the value of resources on the other. These are hot spots, cold spots, and horse trading. Hotspots are activities that have low resource input but high potential performance gains. In contrast, cold spots are activities that have high resource input but low performance impact. In every organization, hotspots and cold spots typically abound. Horse trading involves trading your unit's excess resources in one area for another unit's excess resources to fill remaining resource gaps. By learning to use their current resources right, companies often find they can tip the resource hurdle outright. What actions consume your greatest resources but have scant performance impact? Conversely, what activities have the greatest performance impact but are resource-starved? When the questions are framed in this way, organizations rapidly gain insight into freeing up low-return resources and redirecting them to high-impact areas. In this way, both lower costs and higher value are simultaneously pursued and achieved. Redistribute resources to your hotspots. At the New York Transit Police, Bratton's predecessors argued that to make the city's subways safe, they had to have an officer ride every subway line and patrol every entrance and exit. To increase profits, lower crime, would mean increasing costs, police officers, in multiples that were not possible given the budget. The underlying logic was that increments in performance could be achieved only with proportional increments in resources, the same inherent logic guiding most companies' view of performance gains. Bratton, however, achieved the sharpest drop in subway crime, fear, and disorder in transit's history, not with more police officers, but with the police officers targeted at hotspots. His analysis revealed that, although the subway system was a maze of lines and entrances and exits, the vast majority of crimes occurred at only a few stations and on a few lines. He also found that these hotspots were starved for police attention, even though they exercised a disproportionate impact on crime performance, whereas lines and stations that almost never reported criminal activity were staffed equally. The solution was a complete refocusing of cops at subway hotspots to overwhelm the criminal element, and crime came tumbling down while the size of the police force remained constant. Similarly, before Bratton's arrival at the NYPD, the narcotics unit worked 9-to-5 weekday-only shifts and made up less than 5% of the department's human resources. To search out resource hotspots, in one of his initial meetings with the NYPD's chiefs, Bratton's Deputy Commissioner of Crime Strategy, Jack Maple, asked people around the table for their estimates of the percentage of crimes attributable to narcotics usage. Most said 50%, others 70%. The lowest estimate was 30%. On that basis, as Maple pointed out, it was hard to argue that a narcotics unit consisting of less than 5% of the NYPD force was not grossly understaffed. What's more, it turned out that the narcotics squad largely worked Monday to Friday, even though most drugs were sold over the weekend when drug-related crimes persistently occurred. Why? That was the way it had always been. It was the unquestioned modus operandi. When these facts were presented and the hotspot identified, Bratton's case for a major reallocation of staff and resources within the NYPD was quickly accepted. Accordingly, Bratton reallocated staff and resources on the hotspot, and drug crime plummeted. Where did he get the resources to do this? He simultaneously assessed his organization's cold spots. Redirect resources from your cold spots. Leaders need to free up resources by searching out cold spots. Again, in the subway, Bratton found that one of the biggest cold spots was processing criminals in court. On average, it would take an officer 16 hours to take someone downtown to process even the pettiest of crimes. This was time officers were not patrolling the subway and adding value. Bratton changed all that. Instead of bringing criminals to the court, he brought processing centers to the criminals by using bust buses, roving old buses retrofitted into miniature police stations that were parked outside subway stations. Now, instead of dragging a suspect down to the courthouse across town, a police officer needed only escort the suspect up to street level to the bus. This cut processing time from 16 hours to just one, freeing more officers to patrol the subway and catch criminals. Engage in horse trading. In addition to internally refocusing the resources a unit already controls, tipping point leaders skillfully trade resources they don't need for those of others that they do need. Consider again the case of Bratton. The chiefs of public sector organizations know that the size of their budgets and the number of people they control are often hotly debated because public sector resources are notoriously limited. This makes chiefs of public sector organizations unwilling to advertise excess resources, let alone release them for use by other parts of the larger organization, because that would risk a loss of control over those resources. One result is that over time, some organizations become well endowed with resources they don't need, even while they are short of ones they do need. On taking over as chief of the New York Transit Police in 1990, Bratton's general counsel and policy advisor, Dean Esserman, now police chief of Providence, Rhode Island, played a key horse trading role. Esserman discovered that the transit unit, which was starved for office space, had been running a fleet of unmarked cars in excess of its needs. The New York Division of Parole, on the other hand, was short of cars but had excess office space. Esserman and Bratton offered the obvious trade, which was gratefully accepted by the parole officials. For their part, transit unit officers were delighted to get the first floor of a prime downtown building. The deal stoked Bratton's credibility within the organization, something that later made it easier for him to introduce more fundamental changes. At the same time, it marked him to his political bosses as a man who could solve problems. By de-emphasizing or virtually eliminating some traditional features of transit police work, while increasing emphasis on the others or creating new ones, Bratton achieved a dramatic shift in resource allocation. Whereas the actions of eliminating and reducing cut the costs for the organization, raising certain elements or creating new ones required added investments. However, the overall investment of resources remained more or less constant. At the same time, the value to citizens went way up. Eliminating the practice of widespread coverage of the subway system and replacing it with a targeted strategy on hotspots enabled the transit police to combat subway crimes more efficiently and effectively. Reducing the involvement of officers in processing arrests or cold spots and creating bust buses significantly raised the value of the police force by allowing officers to concentrate their time and attention on policing the subway. Raising the level of investment in combating quality of life crimes rather than big crimes refocused the police resources on crimes that presented constant dangers to citizens' daily lives. Through these moves, the New York Transit Police significantly enhanced the performance of its officers, who were now freed from administrative hassles and assigned clear duties as to what kinds of crimes they should focus on and where to combat them. Are you allocating resources based on old assumptions? Or do you seek out and concentrate resources on hotspots? Where are your hotspots? What activities have the greatest performance impact but are resource-starved? Where are your cold spots? What activities are resource-oversupplied but have scant performance impact? Do you have a horse trader? And what can you trade? Jump the motivational hurdle. To reach your organization's tipping point and execute Blue Ocean strategy, you must alert employees to the need for a strategic shift and identify how it can be achieved with limited resources. For a new strategy to become a movement, people must not only recognize what needs to be done, but they must also act on that insight in a sustained and meaningful way. How can you motivate the mass of employees fast and at low cost? When most business leaders want to break from the status quo and transform their organizations, they issue grand strategic visions and turn to massive top-down mobilization initiatives. They act on the assumption that to create massive reactions, proportionate massive actions are required. But this is often a cumbersome, expensive, and time-consuming process, given the wide variety of motivational needs in most large companies. And overarching strategic visions often inspire lip service instead of the intended action. It would be easier to turn an aircraft carrier around in a bathtub. Or is there another way? Instead of diffusing change efforts widely, tipping point leaders follow a reverse course and seek massive concentration. They focus on three factors of disproportionate influence in motivating employees, what we call kingpins, fishbowl management, and atomization. Zoom in on kingpins. For strategic change to have real impact, employees at every level must move en masse. To trigger an epidemic movement of positive energy, however, you should not spread your efforts thin. Rather, you should concentrate your efforts on kingpins, the key influencers in the organization. These are people inside the organization who are natural leaders, who are well-respected and persuasive, or who have an ability to unlock or block access to key resources. As with kingpins in bowling, when you hit them straight on, all the other pins come toppling down. This frees an organization from tackling everyone, and yet in the end, everyone is touched and changed. And because in most organizations there are a relatively small number of key influencers who tend to share common problems and concerns, it is relatively easy for the CEO to identify and motivate them. At the NYPD, for example, Bratton zoomed in on the 76 precinct heads as his key influencers and kingpins. Why? Each precinct head directly controlled 200 to 400 police officers. Hence, galvanizing these 76 heads would have the natural ripple effect of touching and motivating the 36,000-deep police force to embrace the new policing strategy. Place kingpins in a fishbowl. At the heart of motivating the kingpins in a sustained and meaningful way is to shine a spotlight on their actions in a repeated and highly visible way. This is what we refer to as fishbowl management, where kingpins' actions and inaction are made as transparent to others as are fish in a bowl of water. By placing kingpins in a fishbowl in this way, you greatly raise the stakes of inaction. Light is shined on who is lagging behind, and a fair stage is set for rapid change agents to shine. For fishbowl management to work, it must be based on transparency, inclusion, and fair process. At the NYPD, Bratton's fishbowl was a biweekly crime strategy review meeting known as CompStat that brought together the city's top brass to review the performance of all the 76 precinct commanders in executing its new strategy. Attendance was mandatory for all precinct commanders. Three-star chiefs, deputy commissioners, and borough chiefs were also required to attend. Bratton himself was there as often as possible. As each precinct commander was questioned on decreases and increases in crime performance in front of peers and superiors based on the organization's new strategic directives, enormous computer-generated overhead maps and charts were shown, visually illustrating in inescapable terms the commander's performance in executing the new strategy. The commander was responsible for explaining the maps, describing how his or her officers were addressing the issues, and outlining why performance was going up or down. These inclusive meetings instantly made results and responsibilities clear and transparent for everyone. As a result, an intense performance culture was created in weeks. Forget about months, let alone years. Because no kingpin wanted to be ashamed in front of others, and they all wanted to shine in front of their peers and superiors. In the fishbowl, incompetent precinct commanders could no longer cover up their failings by blaming their precinct's results on the shortcomings of neighboring precincts, because their neighbors were in the room and could respond. Indeed, a picture of the precinct commander to be grilled at the crime strategy meetings was printed on the front page of the handout, emphasizing that the commander was responsible and accountable for that precinct's results. By the same token, the fishbowl gave an opportunity for high achievers to gain recognition for work in their own precincts and in helping others. The meetings also provided an opportunity for policy leaders to compare notes on their experiences. Before Bratton's arrival, precinct commanders seldom got together as a group. Over time, this style of fishbowl management filtered down the ranks, as the precinct commanders tried out their own versions of Bratton's meetings. With the spotlight shining brightly on their performance in strategy execution, the precinct commanders were highly motivated to get all the officers under their control marching to the new strategy. For this to work, however, organizations must simultaneously make fair process the modus operandi. By fair process, we mean engaging all the affected people in the process, explaining to them the basis of decisions and the reasons people will be promoted or sidestepped in the future, and setting clear expectations of what that means to employees' performance. At the NYPD's crime strategy review meetings, no one could argue that the playing field wasn't fair. The fishbowl was applied to all kingpins. There was clear transparency in the assessment of every commander's performance and how it would tie into advancement or demotion. And clear expectations were set in every meeting of what was expected in performance from everyone. In this way, fair process signals to people that there is a level playing field and that leaders value employees' intellectual and emotional worth, despite all the change that may be required. This greatly mitigates feelings of suspicion and doubt that are almost necessarily present in employees' minds when a company is trying to make a major strategic shift. The cushion of support provided by fair process, combined with the fishbowl emphasis on sheer performance, pushes people and supports them on the journey, demonstrating managers' intellectual and emotional respect for employees. For a fuller discussion on fair process and its motivational implications, see Chapter 8. Atomize to get the organization to change itself. The last disproportionate influence factor is atomization. Atomization relates to the framing of the strategic challenge, one of the most subtle and sensitive tasks of the tipping point leader. Unless people believe that the strategic challenge is attainable, the change is not likely to succeed. On the face of it, Bratton's goal in New York City was so ambitious as to be scarcely believable. Who could believe that anything an individual could do would turn such a huge city from being the most dangerous place in the country into the safest? And who would want to invest time and energy in chasing an impossible dream? To make the challenge attainable, Bratton broke it into bite-sized atoms that officers at different levels could relate to. As he put it, the challenge facing the NYPD was to make the streets of New York City safe, block by block, precinct by precinct, and borough by borough. Thus framed, the challenge was both all-encompassing and doable. For officers on the street, the challenge was to make their beat or block safe. No more. For the precinct commanders, the challenge was to make their precinct safe. No more. Borough heads also had a concrete goal within their capabilities, making their boroughs safe. No more. No one could say that what was being asked of them was too tough. No one could claim that achieving it was largely out of their hands. It's beyond me. In this way, responsibility for executing Bratton's Blue Ocean strategy shifted from him to each of the NYPD's 36,000 officers. Do you indiscriminately try to motivate the masses, or do you focus on key influencers, your kingpins? Do you put the spotlight on and manage kingpins in a fishbowl based on fair process? Or do you just demand high performance and cross your fingers until the next quarter numbers come out? Do you issue grand strategic visions, or do you atomize the issue to make it actionable to all levels? Knock over the political hurdle. Youth and skill will win out every time over age and treachery. True or false? False. Even the best and brightest are regularly eaten alive by politics, intrigue, and plotting. Organizational politics is an inescapable reality of corporate and public life. Even if an organization has reached the tipping point of execution, there exist powerful vested interests that will resist the impending changes. Also see our discussion on adoption hurdles in Chapter 6. The more likely change becomes, the more fiercely and vocally these negative influencers, both internal and external, will fight to protect their positions. And their resistance can seriously damage and even derail the strategy execution process. To overcome these political forces, tipping point leaders focus on three disproportionate influence factors: leveraging angels, silencing devils, and getting a consigliere on their top management team. Angels are those who have the most to gain from the strategic shift. Devils are those who have the most to lose from it. And a consigliere is a politically adept but highly respected insider who knows in advance all the landmines, including who will fight you and who will support you. Secure a consigliere on your top management team. Most leaders concentrate on building a top management team having strong functional skills, such as marketing, operations, and finance. And that is important. Tipping point leaders, however, also engage one role few other executives think to include: a consigliere. To that end, Bratton, for example, always ensured that he had a respected senior insider on his top team who knew the landmines he would face in implementing the new policing strategy. At NYPD, Bratton appointed John Timoney, now the police commissioner of Miami, as his number two. Timoney was a cop's cop, respected and feared for his dedication to the NYPD and for the more than 60 decorations and combat crosses he had received. 20 years in the ranks had taught him not only who all the key players were, but also how they played the political game. One of the first tasks Timoney did was report to Bratton on the likely attitudes of the top staff to the NYPD's new policing strategy, identifying those who would fight or silently sabotage the new initiative. This led to a dramatic changing of the guard. Leverage your angels and silence your devils. To knock down the political hurdles, you should also ask yourself two sets of questions. Who are my devils? Who will fight me? Who will lose the most by the future Blue Ocean strategy? Who are my angels? Who will naturally align with me? Who will gain the most by the strategic shift? Don't fight alone. Get the higher and wider voice to fight with you. Identify your detractors and supporters, forget the middle, and strive to create a win-win outcome for both. But move quickly. Isolate your detractors by building a broader coalition with your angels before a battle begins. In this way, you will discourage the war before it has a chance to start or gain steam. One of the most serious threats to Bratton's new policing strategy came from New York City's courts. Believing that Bratton's new policing strategy of focusing on quality-of-life crimes would overwhelm the system with small crime cases, such as prostitution and public drunkenness, the courts opposed the strategic shift. To overcome this opposition, Bratton clearly illustrated to his supporters, including the mayor, district attorneys, and jail managers, that the court system could indeed handle the added quality-of-life crimes, and that focusing on them would in the long term actually reduce their caseload. The mayor decided to intervene. Then Bratton's coalition, led by the mayor, went on the offensive in the press with a clear and simple message. If the courts did not pull their weight, the city's crime rate would not go down. Bratton's alliance with the mayor's office and the city's leading newspaper successfully isolated the courts. They could hardly be seen to publicly oppose an initiative that would not only make New York a more attractive place to live, but would also ultimately reduce the number of cases brought before them. With the mayor speaking aggressively in the press of the need to pursue quality-of-life crimes, and the city's most respected and liberal newspaper giving credence to the new police strategy, the costs of fighting Bratton's strategy were daunting. Bratton had won the battle, The courts would comply. He also won the war. Crime rates did indeed come down. Key to winning over your detractors or devils is knowing all their likely angles of attack and building up counterarguments backed by irrefutable facts and reason. For example, when the NYPD's precinct commanders were first requested to compile detailed crime data and maps, they balked at the idea, arguing that it would take too much time. Anticipating this reaction, Bratton had already done a test run of the operation to see how long it would take. No more than 18 minutes a day, which worked out, as he told the commanders, to less than 1% of their average workload. Armed with irrefutable information, he was able to tip the political hurdle and win the battle before it even began. Do you have a consigliere, a highly respected insider, in your top management team? Or only a CFO and other functional head heads? Do you know who will fight you and who will align with the new strategy? Have you built coalitions with natural allies to encircle dissidents? Do you have your consigliere remove the biggest landmines so that you don't have to focus on changing those who cannot and will not change? Challenging conventional wisdom. The conventional theory of organizational change rests on transforming the mass. So, change efforts are focused on moving the mass, requiring steep resources and long time frames, luxuries few executives can afford. Tipping point leadership, by contrast, takes a reverse course. To change the mass, it focuses on transforming the extremes, the people, acts, and activities that exercise a disproportionate influence on performance. By transforming the extremes, tipping point leaders are able to change the core fast and at low cost to execute their new strategy. It is never easy to execute a strategic shift, and doing it fast with limited resources is even more difficult. Yet our research suggests that it can be achieved by leveraging tipping point leadership. By consciously addressing the hurdles to strategy execution and focusing on factors of disproportionate influence, you too can knock them over to actualize a strategic shift. Don't follow conventional wisdom. Not every challenge requires a proportionate action. Focus on acts of disproportionate influence. This is a critical leadership component for making Blue Ocean Strategy happen. It aligns employees' actions with the new strategy. The next chapter drills down one level further. It addresses the challenge of aligning people's minds and hearts with the new strategy by building a culture of trust, commitment, and voluntary cooperation in its execution, as well as support for the leader. Addressing this challenge spells the difference between forced execution and voluntary execution driven by people's free will. Chapter 8. Build Execution into Strategy. A company is not only top management, nor is it only middle management. A company is everyone from the top to the front lines. And it is only when all the members of an organization are aligned around a strategy and support it, for better or for worse, that a company stands apart as a great and consistent executor. Overcoming the organizational hurdles to strategy execution is an important step toward that end. It removes the roadblocks that can put a halt to even the best of strategies. But in the end, a company needs to invoke the most fundamental base of action— the attitudes and behavior of its people deep in the organization. You must create a culture of trust and commitment that motivates people to execute the agreed strategy, not to the letter, but to the spirit. People's minds and hearts must align with the new strategy so that at the level of the individual, people embrace it of their own accord and willingly go beyond compulsory execution to voluntary cooperation in carrying it out. Where Blue Ocean Strategy is concerned, this challenge is heightened. Trepidation builds as people are required to step out of their comfort zones and change how they have worked in the past. They wonder, what are the real reasons for this change? Is top management honest when it speaks of building future growth through a change in strategic course? Or are they trying to make us redundant and work us out of our jobs? The more removed people are from the top and the less they have been involved in the creation of the strategy, the more this trepidation builds. On the front line, at the very level at which a strategy must be executed day in and day out, people can resent having a strategy thrust upon them with little regard for what they think and feel. Just when you think you have done everything right, things can go suddenly very wrong in your front line. This brings us to the sixth principle of Blue Ocean Strategy. To build people's trust and commitment deep in the ranks and inspire their voluntary cooperation, companies need to build execution into strategy from the start. That principle allows companies to minimize the management risk of distrust, non-cooperation, and even sabotage. This management risk is relevant to strategy execution in both red and blue oceans, but it is greater for blue ocean strategy because its execution often requires significant change. Hence, minimizing such risk is essential as companies execute blue ocean strategy. Companies must reach beyond the usual suspects of carrots and sticks. They must reach to fair process in the making and executing of strategy. Our research shows that fair process is a key variable that distinguishes successful blue ocean strategic moves from those that failed. The presence or absence of fair process can make or break a company's best execution efforts. Poor process can ruin strategy execution. Consider the experience of a global leader in supplying water-based liquid coolants for metalworking industries. We'll call this organization Lubber. Because of the many processing parameters in metal-based manufacturing, there are several hundred complex types of coolants to choose from. Choosing the right coolant is a delicate process. Products must first be tested on production machines before purchasing, and the decision often rests on fuzzy logic. The result is machine downtime and sampling costs, and these are expensive for customers and Lubber alike. To offer customers a leap in value, Lubber devised a strategy to eliminate the complexity and costs of the trial phase. Using artificial intelligence, it developed an expert system that cut the failure rate in selecting coolants to less than 10% from an industry average of 50%. The system also reduced machine downtime, eased coolant management, and raised the overall quality of workpieces produced. As for Lubber, the sales process was dramatically simplified, giving sales representatives more time to gain new sales and dropping the costs per sale. This win-win value innovation strategic move, however, was doomed from the start. It wasn't that the strategy was not good or that the expert system did not work. It worked exceptionally well. The strategy was doomed because the sales force fought it. Having not been engaged in the strategy-making process nor apprised of the rationale for the strategic shift, sales reps saw the expert system in a light no one on the design team or management team had ever imagined. To them, it was a direct threat to what they saw as their most valuable contribution, tinkering in the trial phase to find the right water-based coolant from the long list of possible candidates. All the wonderful benefits, having a way to avoid the hassle-filled part of their job, having more time to pull in more sales, and winning more contracts by standing out in the industry, went unappreciated. With the sales force feeling threatened and often working against the expert system by expressing doubts about its effectiveness to customers, sales did not take off. After cursing its hubris and learning the hard way the importance of dealing with managerial risk up front based on the proper process, management was forced to pull the expert system from the market and work on rebuilding trust with its sales representatives. The power of fair process. What then is fair process, and how does it allow companies to build execution into strategy? The theme of fairness or justice has preoccupied writers and philosophers throughout the ages. But the direct theoretical origin of fair process traces back to two social scientists, John W. Thibeau and Lawrence Walker. In the mid-1970s, they combined their interest in the psychology of justice with the study of process, creating the term procedural justice. Focusing their attention on legal settings, they sought to understand what makes people trust a legal system so that they will comply with laws without being coerced. Their research established that people care as much about the justice of the process through which an outcome is produced as they do about the outcome itself. People's satisfaction with the outcome and their commitment to it rose when procedural justice was exercised. Fair process is our managerial expression of procedural justice theory. As in legal settings, fair process builds execution into strategy by creating people's buy-in up front. When fair process is exercised in the strategy-making process, people trust that a level playing field exists. This inspires them to cooperate voluntarily in executing the resulting strategic decisions. Voluntary cooperation is more than mechanical execution, where people do only what it takes to get by. It involves going beyond the call of duty, wherein individuals exert energy and initiative to the best of their abilities, even subordinating personal self-interest, to execute resulting strategies. The three E principles of fair process. There are three mutually reinforcing elements that define fair process: engagement, explanation, and clarity of expectation. Whether people are senior executives or shop floor employees, they all look to these elements. We call them the three E principles of fair process. Engagement means involving individuals in the strategic decisions that affect them by asking for their input and allowing them to refute the merits of one another's ideas and assumptions. Engagement communicates management's respect for individuals and their ideas. Encouraging refutation sharpens everyone's thinking and builds better collective wisdom. Engagement results in better strategic decisions by management and greater commitment from all involved to execute those decisions. Explanation means that everyone involved and affected should understand why final strategic decisions are made as they are. An explanation of the thinking that underlies decisions makes people confident that managers have considered their opinions and have made decisions impartially in the overall interests of the company. An explanation allows employees to trust managers' intentions even if their own ideas have been rejected. It also serves as a powerful feedback loop that enhances learning. Expectation clarity requires that after a strategy is set, managers state clearly the new rules of the game. Although the expectations may be demanding, employees should know up front what standards they will be judged by and the penalties for failure. What are the goals of the new strategy? What are the new targets and milestones? Who is responsible for what? To achieve fair process, it matters less what the new goals, expectations, and responsibilities are, and more that they are clearly understood. When people clearly understand what is expected of them, political jockeying and favoritism are minimized, and people can focus on executing the strategy rapidly. Taken together, these three criteria collectively lead to judgments of fair process. This is important because any subset of the three does not create judgments of fair process. A Tale of Two Plants. How do the three E principles of fair process work to affect strategy execution deep in an organization? Consider the experience of an elevator systems manufacturer we'll call Elco. In the late 1980s, sales in the elevator industry declined. Excess office space left some large U.S. cities with vacancy rates as high as 20%. With domestic demand falling, Elco set out to offer buyers a leap in value while lowering its costs to stimulate new demand and break from the competition. In its quest to create and execute a blue ocean strategy, the company realized that it needed to replace its batch manufacturing system with a cellular approach that would allow self-directed teams to achieve superior performance. The management team was in agreement and ready to go. To execute this key element of its strategy, the team adopted what looked like the fastest and smartest way to move forward. It would first install the new system at Elco's Chester plant and then roll it out to its second plant, High Park. The logic was simple. The Chester plant had exemplary employee relations, so much so that the workers had decertified their own union. Management was certain it could count on employee cooperation to execute the strategic shift in manufacturing. In the company's words, they were the ideal workforce. Next, Elco would roll out the process to its plant in High Park, where a strong union was expected to resist that or any other change. Management was counting on having achieved a degree of momentum for execution at Chester that it hoped would have positive spillover effects on High Park. The theory was good. In practice, however, things took an unprecedented turn. The introduction of the new manufacturing process at the Chester plant quickly led to disorder and rebellion. Within a few months, both cost and quality performance were in freefall. Employees were talking about bringing back the union. Having lost control, the despairing plant manager called Elko's industrial psychologist for help. In contrast, the High Park plant, despite its reputation for resistance, had accepted the strategic shift in the manufacturing process. Every day, the High Park manager waited for the anticipated meltdown, but it never came. Even when people didn't like the decisions, they felt they had been treated fairly, and so they willingly participated in the rapid execution of the new manufacturing process, a pivotal component of the company's new strategy. A closer look at the way the strategic shift was made at the two plants reveals the reasons behind this apparent anomaly. At the Chester plant, Elko managers violated all three of the basic principles of fair process. First, they failed to engage employees in the strategic decisions that directly affected them. Lacking expertise in cellular manufacturing, Elko brought in a consulting firm to design a master plan for the conversion. The consultants were briefed to work quickly and with minimal disturbance to employees so that fast, painless implementation could be achieved. The consultants followed the instructions. When Chester employees arrived at work, they discovered strangers at the plant who not only dressed differently, wearing dark suits, white shirts, and ties, but also spoke in low tones to one another. To minimize disturbance, they didn't interact with employees. Instead, they quietly hovered behind people's backs, taking notes and drawing diagrams. The rumor circulated that after employees went home in the afternoon, these same people would swarm across the plant floor, snoop around people's workstations, and have heated discussions. During this period, the plant manager was increasingly absent. He was spending more time at Elko's head office in meetings with the consultants, sessions deliberately scheduled away from the plant so as not to distract the employees. But the plant manager's absence produced the opposite effect. As people grew anxious, wondering why the captain of their ship seemed to be deserting them, the rumor mill moved into high gear. Everyone became convinced that the consultants would downsize the plant. They were sure they were about to lose their jobs. The fact that the plant manager was always gone without any explanation, obviously he was avoiding them, could only mean that management was, they thought, trying to put one over on us. Trust and commitment at the Chester plant deteriorated quickly. Soon people were bringing in newspaper clippings about other plants around the country that had been shut down with the help of consultants. Employees saw themselves as imminent victims of management's hidden intention to downsize and work people out of their jobs. In fact, Elko managers had no intention of closing the plant. They wanted to cut waste, freeing people to produce higher quality elevators faster at lower cost to leapfrog the competition. But plant employees could not have known that. Managers at Chester also didn't explain why strategic decisions were being made the way they were, and what those decisions meant to employees' careers and work methods. Management unveiled the master plan for change in a 30-minute session with employees. The audience heard that their time-honored way of working would be abolished and replaced by something called cellular manufacturing. No one explained why the strategic shift was needed, how the company needed to break away from the competition to stimulate new demand, and why the shift in the manufacturing process was a key element of that strategy. Employees sat in stunned silence, with no understanding of the rationale behind the change. The managers mistook this for acceptance, forgetting how long it had taken them over the preceding few months to get comfortable with the idea of shifting to cellular manufacturing to execute the new strategy. Master plan in hand, management quickly began rearranging the plant. When employees asked what the new layout aimed to achieve, the response was efficiency gains. The managers didn't have time to explain why efficiency had to be improved and didn't want to worry employees. But lacking an intellectual understanding of what was happening to them, some employees began feeling sick as they came to work. Managers also neglected to make clear what would be expected of employees under the new manufacturing process. They informed employees that they would no longer be judged on individual performance, but rather on the performance of the cell. They said that faster or more experienced employees would have to pick up the slack for slower or less experienced colleagues. But they didn't elaborate. How the new cellular system was supposed to work, managers didn't make clear. Violations of the principles of fair process undermined employees' trust in the strategic shift and in management. In fact, the new cell design offered tremendous benefits to employees, for example, making vacations easier to schedule and giving them the opportunity to broaden their skills and engage in a greater variety of work. Yet employees could see only its negative side. They began taking out their fear and anger on one another. Fights erupted on the plant floor as employees refused to help those they called lazy people who can't finish their own jobs, or interpreted offers of help as meddling, responding with, "This is my job, you keep to your own workstation." Chester's model workforce was falling apart. For the first time in the plant manager's career, employees refused to do as they were asked, turning down assignments, "Even if you fire me." They felt they could no longer trust the once popular plant manager, so they began to go around him, taking their complaints directly to his boss at the head office. In the absence of fair process, the Chester plant's employees rejected the transformation and refused to play their role in executing the new strategy. In contrast, management at the High Park plant abided by all three principles of fair process when introducing the strategic shift. When the consultants came to the plant manager introduced them to all employees. Management engaged employees by holding a series of plant-wide meetings, where corporate executives openly discussed the declining business conditions and the company's need for a change in strategic course to break from the competition and simultaneously achieve higher value at lower cost. They explained that they had visited other companies' plants and had seen the productivity improvements that cellular manufacturing could bring. They explained how this would be a pivotal determinant of the company's ability to achieve its new strategy. They announced a pro-action time policy to calm employees' justifiable fears of layoffs. As old performance measures were discarded, managers worked with employees to develop new ones and to establish each cell team's new responsibilities. Goals and expectations were made clear to employees. By practicing the three principles of fair process in tandem, management won the understanding and support of High Park employees. The employees spoke of their plant manager with admiration, and they commiserated with the difficulties Elko's managers had in executing the new strategy and making the changeover to cellular manufacturing. They concluded that it had been a necessary, worthwhile, and positive experience. Elko's managers still regard this experience as one of the most painful in their careers. They learned that people in the front line care as much about the proper process as those at the top. By violating fair process in making and rolling out strategies, managers can turn their best employees into their worst, earning their distrust of and resistance to the very strategy they depend on them to execute. But if managers practice fair process, the worst employees can turn into the best and can execute even difficult strategic shifts with their willing commitment while building their trust. Why does fair process matter? Why is fair process important in shaping people's attitudes and behavior? Specifically, why does the observance or violation of fair process in strategy making have the power to make or break a strategy's execution? It all comes down to intellectual and emotional recognition. Emotionally, individuals seek recognition of their value, not as labor, personnel, or human resources, but as human beings who are treated with full respect and dignity and appreciated for their individual worth, regardless of hierarchical level. Intellectually, individuals seek recognition that their ideas are sought after and given thoughtful reflection, and that others think enough of their intelligence to explain their thinking to them. Such frequently cited expressions in our interviews as, "That goes for everyone I know," or "Every person wants to feel," and constant references to people and human beings reinforce the point that managers must see the nearly universal value of the intellectual and emotional recognition that fair process conveys. Intellectual and emotional recognition theory. Using fair process in strategy making is strongly linked to both intellectual and emotional recognition. It proves through action that there is an eagerness to trust and cherish the individual, as well as deep-seated confidence in the individual's knowledge, talents, and expertise. When individuals feel recognized for their intellectual worth, they are willing to share their knowledge. In fact, they feel inspired to impress and confirm the expectation of their intellectual value, suggesting active ideas and knowledge sharing. Similarly, when individuals are treated with emotional recognition, they feel emotionally tied to the strategy and inspired to give their all. Indeed, in Frederick Hertzberg's classic study on motivation, recognition was found to inspire strong intrinsic motivation, causing people to go beyond the call of duty and engage in voluntary cooperation. Hence, to the extent that fair process judgments convey intellectual and emotional recognition, people will better apply their knowledge and expertise, as well as their voluntary efforts to cooperate for the organization's success in executing strategy. However, there is a flip side to this that is deserving of equal, if not more, attention. The violation of fair process, and with it the violation of recognizing individuals' intellectual and emotional worth. The observed pattern of thought and behavior can be summarized as follows. If individuals are not treated as though their knowledge is valued, they will feel intellectual indignation and will not share their ideas and expertise. Rather, they will hoard their best thinking and creative ideas, preventing new insights from seeing the light of day. What's more, they will reject others' intellectual worth as well. It's as if they were saying, "You don't value my ideas, so I don't value your ideas, nor do I trust in or care about the strategic decisions you've reached." Similarly, to the extent that people's emotional worth is not recognized, they will feel angry and will not invest their energy in their actions. Rather, they will drag their feet and apply counter-efforts, including sabotage, as in the case of Elko's Chester plant. This often leads employees to push for rolling back strategies that have been imposed unfairly, even when the strategies themselves were good ones, critical to the company's success or beneficial to employees and managers themselves. Lacking trust in the strategy-making process, people lack trust in the resulting strategies. Such is the emotional power that fair process can provoke. Fair process and blue ocean strategy. Commitment, trust, and voluntary cooperation are not merely attitudes or behaviors. They are intangible capital. When people have trust, they have heightened confidence in one another's intentions and actions. When they have commitment, they are even willing to override personal self-interest in the interests of the company. If you ask any company that has created and successfully executed a blue ocean strategy, managers will be quick to rattle off how important this intangible capital is to their success. Similarly, managers from companies that have failed in executing blue ocean strategies will point out that the lack of this capital contributed to their failure. These companies were not able to orchestrate strategic shifts because they lacked people's trust and commitment. Commitment, trust, and voluntary cooperation allow companies to stand apart in the speed, quality, and consistency of their execution and to implement strategic shifts fast at low cost. The question companies wrestle with is how to create trust, commitment, and voluntary cooperation deep in the organization. You don't do it by separating strategy formulation from execution. Although this disconnect may be a hallmark of most companies' practice, it is also a hallmark of slow and questionable implementation and mechanical follow-through at best. Of course, traditional incentives of power and money, carrots and sticks, help, but they fall short of inspiring human behavior that goes beyond outcome-driven self-interest. Where behavior cannot be monitored with certainty, there is still plenty of room for foot-dragging and sabotage. The exercise of fair process gets around this dilemma. By organizing the strategy formulation process around the principles of fair process, you can build execution into strategy-making from the start. With fair process, people tend to be committed to support the resulting strategy, even when it is viewed as not favorable or at odds with their perception of what is strategically correct for their unit. People realize that compromises and sacrifices are necessary in building a strong company. They accept the need for short-term personal sacrifices in order to advance the long-term interests of the corporation. This acceptance is conditional, however, on the presence of fair process. Whatever the context in which a company's Blue Ocean strategy is executed, be it working with a joint venture partner to outsource component manufacturing, reorienting the sales force, transforming the manufacturing process, relocating a company's call center from the United States to India, we have consistently observed this dynamic at work. Chapter 9. Conclusion. The sustainability and renewal